Welcome to Hazinu. Hazinu? Yes, because this is the day when Etz Chaim looks at segment 4 of Hazinu, Etz Chaim congregation. And you have it in front of you. This is sort of a difficult set in Hazinu because it's 10 verses, the fourth segment. And it starts with God being irritated or disgusted. And in fact, he's going to turn his face. And when he turns his face, then it's really going to be difficult times for our people. So we're really dealing with the downward spiral and the unwinding of curses at this point. Curses of because of our past. And I'll go through a summary of that. But first I'd like to sing together verses 19 through 28. Let's do it in English, and then we'll do it in the Torah when we're after the sermon, after the review. And saw the Lord and spurned because of vexation his sons and his daughters. And he said, I want to hide my face from them. I want to see what is there hereafter. For a generation upside down are they, children without faithfulness in them. They made me red-faced with a no-god. They vexed me with airy idols. And I shall make them red-faced with a no-people. With a nation of fools I shall vex them. For fire has ignited in my nostrils. It will burn to Sheol beneath, devour the earth and her produce, and scorch the foundations of mountains. I will heap upon them evils. With my arrows I will finish them. Wasted by famine, and ravaged by plague and pestilence so bitter. Fangs of beasts I'll let loose on them, with venom of creepers in the dust. Outside deals death the sword, and from rooms terror. Both young men and young women, infants with men of gray hair. I would have said, I'll hack them to pieces, cause to cease from mankind their remembrance, except the taunt of the enemy I dread, lest would misconstrue his foes, lest they would say, our hand is held high, and not the Lord has done all this. For the nation lost in counsel are they, and there's not among them understanding. So, gee, this is going to be God's reaction to the first 18 verses in Hazinu. It seems like a summary then would be in order when one considers this strong a reaction. Going back to verses 1 through 6 in Hazinu, we see that there's a summons. God summons heaven and earth. He says, Hazinu Hashemayim Vadabera, give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and may hear the earth. So God is saying, What Moses is being directed to do, to sing to heavens, it's going to be brought down. And when it's brought down, then the earth will hear. So there's this antiphonal response between the idea that what happens in heaven is done on earth, and speaking to heaven, the words go up, and then they come down, and there's an impact on the earth. And the earth is actually hearing or responding. The earth, as it were, is like a moon. Heavens are like a sun. The sun is the source of light. And so the source is that we're speaking to heaven. The source is that God is the one who created heaven. And the response is what happens on earth. The response is a spiritual reality being played out on earth. So he goes on then and talks about this, let trickle like dew, my teaching. It's like the rain comes down, and what does it cause? It causes blankets of green to appear in the mountains. Why? Because the water fertilizes the mountains and begets life. So let my teaching penetrate. Okay. And then what happens? He starts by saying God is praiseworthy. He's a rock. And what do we learn about a rock?
It's stable.
Strong. Permanent.
Foundational.
And it's straight. Mm-hmm. And you don't mess with a rock. It also provides shelter. So you've got shelter, protection, stability. And in addition, you've got this idea that a rock doesn't twist, doesn't lie, doesn't move,
doesn't
off
change.
Center, doesn't change. Mm-hmm. And the truth is like that. And when we're tricky with our words, it's the opposite. So what happens? Israel comes along, and the generation that follows, the generation is Dori Kesh, Uftal Tol, a generation
crooked and twisted.
So it's like, well, how come this generation is this way? And they ask, Halo, Hu Avi Hakanecha is not ki, your father who ransomed you. And that Kanecha, Kone, Kaniti, Eve said, Kaniti, I Kaniti the man. I acquired a man from God. This was when Cain was born. She said, I got this. And at the Exodus, when we walk across on dry ground, God kanitis us. He says, the people pass through while God ransoms a people. And who pays the price? The firstborn sons are ransomed from Egypt, and Egypt's firstborn sons are drowned. Egypt's firstborn army is drowned. Egypt's firstborn pharaoh, that's going to be the next pharaoh in the dynasty, dies in the house along with all the death of the firstborns in Egypt. So when God crosses over, he's ransoming people in Egypt, actually paying a price in blood. And their firstborns are dying while God's firstborn, his corporate firstborn, Israel, Exodus 4:22, Israel's my firstborn. His corporate firstborn is being pulled out of Egypt. And Egypt is Paro. Paro is Egypt with a capital E, right? And Paro means
big house
in Egyptian. So God goes to big house and he says, I'm taken for my house. And what he asks to do, build a tabernacle, and he fills it with his presence and gets in the center of the camp, and suddenly you've got the sons, Israel, corporate son Israel, taking refuge on the sanctuary property and being given protection by the rock. God is the stability. God is the power and the source that births us. So God is praiseworthy. He's a rock. And if he's that way, then how come the generation, how come the firstborn son, how come the Rishonim in the wilderness, the old guard that was 20 to 60 in the army, doesn't follow orders, breaks down chain of command by not doing what God wants us to do. And the result is you've got a twisted and crooked generation when you've got God giving birth to this, because he's the guy that connected us. He's the guy that acquired us. He's the guy that ransomed us. He's the guy that begot us. Well, here he's going to say he's the guy that created us. You know, who avicha kanecha. He is your father who created, ransomed.
Or birthed you.
Well, that's going to be later, the rock. Yaladotcha keshi. We'll get to who yaladotcha, the rock that bore you ignored. But that's a few verses later in the review. Right now we're in six verses. And there, the idea then is this twisted or faithless generation. I mean, God is going to refer to us as Yeshurun, his little straight one. Yashar is straight. A rock, you know, when you're putting it down, like the foundation stone, if I take the foundation stone and I put it right here, and that's cornerstone, then it tells me, here's the temple. This is what the foundation's going to look like. Build this way. And I got the exact way I want it to point. I lay in the cornerstone. So when I put the cornerstone down, mm-hmm. it determines three corners in the square. I just have to level off and meet myself, but I've got two lines going out here, mm-hmm. and it determines the exact location of the foundation and the exact lay, what east is going to be and where the tabernacle is going to be and where the center of the building is going to be. It's all determined by putting a cornerstone down. So here, we've got this corner, and we've got this stone, we've got rock, we've got God, our rock, and he's our foundation, and he's going to build this eventually going to go to the place Israel, to Jerusalem, where he's going to make his name to dwell, and we're going to rediscover, according to tradition, the very place where Abraham offers up Isaac, and God's going to go there and make his name to dwell there, and he's going to have us build there a temple, and he's going to lay a cornerstone there in order to build the temple. And was somebody telling me this week they just found David's
seal.
First temple seal. It's a Solomon seal. So we have a twisted, faithless generation, Yeshurun. Yeshurun is little straight one, except we're not straight. And if God is Yasha, God is straight, God's a corner, God's the one that gives us what the straight direction is, God is truth, then how can God, our Father, our procreator, because in every marriage, one guy plants, another guy's water, another guy caused the increase. Who caused the increase? God's a silent partner in every marriage. Now, it requires man and woman to sign off, create Adam. But it requires God to cause the increase. He's a silent third partner. He's a procreator. And then when he gives us the idea of what it is to be a father, what it is to have a heritage, what it is to be like him, and to be an elder and to tell stories across generations, and to be a 10th generation bigwig like Abraham or David, some of these people whose names go for generation after generation, and they're remembered. Mm-hmm. God is out there giving us a taste that he does it with the parameters and we do it with the variables. He creates the universe and then we play with this stuff like it's clay. And he creates ex nihilo. He speaks and makes it come in. And then we mold like he does. So we play with clay while he plays with creating the ingredients that make up clay. Uh-huh. And he makes it possible. He creates the playground and then we go play. And we learn to be like him. So how is this Father, God, giving birth to this son, Israel, who's anything but Yashar when the father's characteristic is Yashar? And so verse 5 asks, Shehet lo lo banav mumam. You know, does it blemish him? Is it corrupting him? Verse 5 is kind of like, did it corrupt him? Did it corrupt him? No. Well, why not? His children,
the blemish is theirs.
A generation twisted and crooked. So verse 5 is telling us, okay, we're understanding there's a lot of free will out here, and God even gives us free will to go our own way, that he imprints us with the Yashar characteristic, calls us Yeshurun, and we grow up Dori Keshuv Talto. We don't pass Torah across generations. A generation comes up twisted and crooked. This kind of thing. But we have free will. And in my expansive mind, I sort of sit down and say, you know, he puts a half angel, half beast in a free-willed being, calls it man, pulls him up out of the ground, and then says, you know, go make a life for yourself. Then we can give in to the carnal instincts and turn into reptiles and carnivores, or we can give in to the greater. In the liturgy, of course, we stand up here, we go, Kadosh, 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 Adonai Tzevaot, holy, holy, holy. And at the end of Tachanun, we're saying, who else says three times, you know, God is holy? Well, the angels in heaven. Isaiah heard it and told us in this vision. And now, what are we doing? Are we becoming like the angels in terms of using our free will to serve the glorious one and becoming straight? Or are we becoming like the carnivores that are going to leave blood on the ground and defile it and kill one another and be blood eaters and not sanctify life, trash life? And actually, carnivores tend to be a little more moral because they kill, then they eat, and they got to eat to kill. We kill and do it for other reasons than just to eat. So when man is a carnivore, this is worse than when other carnivores are walking around. And very few carnivores are just cruel for their own sake. But man is the exception to that kind of rule. So the question then becomes, if God's a cruel creator, and he created us, it's a blemish on his character, and they're telling us right in verse 5, Shehet lo, did it corrupt him? No. No, his children, the blemish is theirs. So we've got the blemish even though we're created in God's image. And even though we're meant to be in God's purposes, Yeshurun, little straight one. And instead we're, what are we?
Little crooked one.
Little crooked one. So that's a summary then of verses 1 to 6. We move on to verses 7 to 12. We deal with origins. Zachor, you know, remember the days of antiquity. And so we've got God alone is the one that teaches his son to soar. Now the oral history is reenacted from generation to generation. That's why we have a Passover. When we have the Passover, our sons come and say, well, what are you doing? And we tell them the Passover story. We've got all these elements that remind us. So we're dipping parsley or we're eating the bitter herbs and reminding ourselves of the bitterness of slavery. It's like, if you can't taste it, then you're going to have to taste it in a more profound way, like in your experience. Like when another Pharaoh comes and puts you back in his house. And the curses and the covenant will take us generally in the direction toward losing our spirit change, toward losing our houses, toward losing our land and inheritances, and after a while losing the land, and then getting scattered and then being put into the household of somebody else that's serving foreign gods, and then we don't even have freedom of religion anymore to set up our own place to worship God, and before you know it, we're worshiping or we're cleaning out the houses of the idolaters who are involved. And we haven't gotten that far yet because we're still in a free country, but you know, there's a tendency. And Rome came, we were in that position. The Babylonians and the Assyrians came, we were in that position. And then junctures in history, you know, he lets us go back and rebuild a temple, or he sends Yeshua or something like that, and things get turned around. All right, so we're telling these stories, and we're supposed to reenact the idea. And the idea we're reenacting is a VAH, the vicarious appropriation of a heritage. Vicarious because we were there at Sinai. We heard. Sit down, someone. We heard for ourselves. We heard. And the elders tell the stories. And if you look at the Torah history and you see the elders telling the stories, I mean, take a look. A guy like Adam, how old was he? How many years did Adam live?
930.
And how many years did Methuselah live?
969.
Okay. He was born in 687, so if you go from 6... Yeah, he's got it. He's good. You know? You think he was coached or something, but he wasn't. All right, so Methuselah was born in 687. He lived at 969 years, and he dies really the year of the flood, 1656. And now, who was... how old was Shem? See? He's a... Actually, without counting, he's about 600 years. But he was born in 1558, and he goes out to 600 years from there. That's like 2158. And if you say Jacob, when was he born? The answer is like 2108, and he lives to 2255. So you can actually have an idea here that in terms of the Torah history, when they're talking about an oral tradition, a guy like Adam could have told his story to Methuselah, who could have transmitted it to Shem, who goes on the ark. And, you know, at the age of 100, Shem is having a kid. 9 generations after Shem, Abraham is going to have a kid at the age of 100. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the oral tradition, you've got Adam moving to Methuselah, Methuselah telling Shem, and Shem could have gone to Isaac's Brit or Isaac's circumcision. Isaac's Pidyon HaBen, one or the other, the tradition says they made the journey across the river at that time. And obviously, if they were alive and they lived as long as the Torah says, and people didn't travel around a whole lot, you would know who your firstborn son would be, and you would know who his firstborn son would be, because he would tell you. And he would tell his father who his firstborn son is, and they would tell you. And it would get back to you every time you had a firstborn son, and you're another generation. So if you're living 900 years, I mean, you're used to looking across 9 or 10 generations, and it isn't any weirder than a grandparent today wanting to be a grandparent and look across 3 or 4 generations. In fact, it's more important when you're moving less and when you don't have television to distract you. It's really going to be important. In an oral tradition, everybody's going to know who their parents are, and everybody's going to know where they descended from. And if you think of the millennium, it's like there might be a lot of people that look like you, or to reverse it, you might look like your father's 5, 10, 20 generations back, and there might be a lot of twins around that we don't even have a clue over because the common gene pools, and I'm not saying identical twins, fraternal twins, but they're going to look.
So that when you cluster people later, you say, oh, you know, everybody here, you know, they got the same wink as that guy. That was Jehoiada or somebody, you know, Yeshayahu, you know. And gee, we all, you know, look like him because of this one incredible characteristic.
Well, I had it just bent a little bit different because somebody told me today that I happen to look like this guy on one of the soap operas.
That's great. See, just today they did it. They were setting up today.
That's
a twin. Yeah. Well, I heard a rumor that that guy was jealous and you know, he made himself look like you when he goes on television. But he doesn't look like you at all, really. It's just on television. So we have this oral tradition. We remember the days of antiquity. And who tells the stories? The fathers and then the elders. And the elders are storytellers. And the elders are guardians of the tradition because they heard it. And they heard it a million times from their father. And they pass it on to you. And if they heard it a million times, you heard it a million times. And when you heard it a million times, you make sure the next guy gets it exactly right. That's how an oral tradition goes along. Until a guy like my father comes along that makes up a few things and adds it. That happens too, you see. So anyway, elders tell the stories. And I wanted you to at least understand that Jacob could have gotten the fourth hand from Adam through Metushalach and Shem. So then Jacob is a man in the tent, so he's going to write this stuff down. And Moses is going to get it pretty soon after Jacob. You see, it's not that far-fetched at that point. The Torah could be written down. You just have to believe these guys lived this long. You see, that's where the stretch can be. But the idea that the order is there is amazing. And the idea of how the oral tradition would work, it's very clear how it would work when you do the math on this. So the division of mankind, then, here's what the story they're telling us. That the nations, you know, everybody went up to take Babel by force. We were building our way up. We were in the material more than people. If people fell off the tower, we didn't cry. But if we lost a brick, we cry. This is in the tradition. And we try to take Babel by force, and God says, we better go down and confuse these guys because we give them free will down here, and if they ally and want an economy that works without God, they can set it up. But let's make it a little hard for them to communicate. Then they won't be able to be so unified. So he gives us language. He spreads us out. And when we get into little geographical areas, he says, you know, I spread everybody out, and I got them in little geographical areas where I appoint boundaries for the people according to the sons of, and we talked about whether it's Israel or B'nai Elohim, the sons of God. And the idea of the sons of God, it's translated in the LXX, the Septuagint, the angels. Angelon Theou, the angels of God. So you've got principalities over nations. That idea is originating in Torah in Hanazino here. And when you have these principalities, then what you've got is that God is making an inheritance to a nation. He spreads them out, gives them a language over here. They build boundaries for themselves within that language. And the language then makes them become what they are. Because these guys over here that live on the sand, they got 21 different names for sand. These guys live in the marshland, they got 21 different names for rain and dew. Everybody starts speaking differently because the terrain makes them look and act and speak and behave differently from their neighbors. And they learn a set of skills that allow them to survive in this environment. These guys learn a set of skills that allow them, and they become different and better at different things. Suddenly you've got clans that act completely differently. When they're intermarrying, they start looking a certain way. You know, you go up to Japheth land in Iceland and everybody looks a certain way. You go down the Mediterranean, they look different. Mm-hmm. See? And it's like, so you can see clans and then people starting to look like their fathers and then whole nations taking on national characteristics. The Jews don't, because we've been in 150 languages. We speak every language around. We've taken every single, even though there's a stereotype for how we're supposed to look, you go to Israel and you find out, you know, there's blue-eyed guys, there's fair-haired guys, there's all kinds of guys around. Because they've already mirrored the nations they've lived in before they moved to Israel. So there's a division of mankind in the nation with lands and with angelic principalities, except Israel. And what is Israel assigned? They're going to get Canaan, and they're going to get God. And God's going to be the overseer. We're supposed to go in. And to go in, you've got to fight an angel. You've got to fight Canaan's principality. Well, you know, Esau isn't the first. I mean, that's not the first time, because Israel had to deal with something before that, even with Jacob. Jacob gets a tradition, and who's he told? Your name is no longer Yaakov, but who?
Israel.
Israel, and what does that mean? Sarara. What's Sarara mean? Sar is prince. Sarara would be mastery. And he's either fighting, Rashi says he's Jacob when he's in Vayetze and Vayishlach, he's over at this He's at the drink, you know. He can't go back because Laban's going to slaughter him. Can't go forward because Esau's coming to greet him with a 400-man raiding party. And it's payback for 22 years of being gone and stealing the birthright. And Jacob's going, what am I going to do? And Esau's coming to greet him, his nice brother who doesn't forget. Nobody forgets stories in the Middle East.
That's
the crossroads.
That's his own crossroads.
It's his own crossroads.
Right.
Haran for him, yeah.
Right.
Well, where's he going to go?
Right.
So he sends the troops across. He sends the concubines. He sends the wives in another company. Divides into three companies and sends them in three directions. So maybe Esau will get one and he'll survive through his concubines. Or he'll survive through his wives. Or his property will survive. And maybe he'll get away and join up with it later. But he's got a problem right now. This guy's come with a 400-man raiding party. You can decimate him. So, and then all night he's fighting somebody he doesn't know who it is, right? And who is it?
A man.
The angel?
See, a man, an angel.
The Lord.
The angel of the Lord.
The angel of the Lord.
Wait, you're talking about
God. Maybe God.
We don't know what it is.
Maybe Jesus.
It's some assailant. Yeah, we don't know. You can speculate. Rashi speculates. It says Esau's angel.
Are you saying that Esau's angel and these principalities are angels of God, or are they the fallen angels?
And well, see, you're getting into a dualism now, and you know you're new here because right. Dualism is not in the Torah, but we'll talk about that.
Yeah, because you and I talked about Genesis 6, where there's fallen angels. Possibly.
There are fallen angels, but the idea that in Judaism, if God's going to go let an angel do something, the angel doesn't have power of life and death. If he doesn't have power of life and death, what's he really doing? He's stirring the pot. If he's stirring the pot, there's nobody that can kill you. There's nobody that can kill God. There's nobody that can overthrow God. There's nobody that can kill you. There's nobody that can overthrow you unless divine permission. So they can only go as far as they're allowed to go. So God is a monism in Judaism. And a monism, he's the big man in charge, and there's no black and white, and there's no dark and light that's going to displace like at night evil is in charge, and at day God is in charge. You go to Egypt and get the sun god, and he goes down and he's got to resurrect. Then you can get something like that. But if you're in Israel, God's everywhere. Everything's under him. There is no other God that compares with him. And even in Hazino, when they're talking about principalities or whatnot, the angels, it's like angels are on a level of deity with God. God is the big man, and there's nothing to be compared. Now, the Masoretes come along later, and they go, this is going to be misunderstood. People are going to think that there's an angelic empire here that can work its way up and overthrow God, especially if human beings almost did it at the Tower of Babel, and God's going to be messing in the spiritual. Somebody's going to take the heavenlies by force or something, and Satan is becoming more powerful, where in the Christian world, you know, suddenly Satan is like practically omniscient, practically omnipotent vis-a-vis man. But if you look at Scripture, he never has power, life, and death. See, if he killed anybody, it was Yeshua, then it was reversed with a resurrection in 3 days, and the power of death is transferred. If he ever had a power of death, it was lost. But he didn't have a power of death as far as Judaism is concerned, because it's a monism, and God's the only guy. And in Hazinu, he'll say, see, now I, Ru Ata, Ki, Ani, Hu, In Elohim, Imadi, Ani amid ve'achaye, I myself give death, restore life. I have wounded and I will heal. This is verse 39 in Hazinu. Nobody else, see me, I alone, me. And he's telling us this, why? Because he needs to tell us this? He's lobbying us. Why is he lobbying us? Because we've been faithless.
And we whore after everybody
And we're whoring after everybody else that's worthless. God's the Torah usually calls him stone. And the prophets come along and call him stone. Now understand that underneath that, there's an idea that this has got an antenna, this spiritual being that's built. And this spiritual being, this deity, this rock-like thing, the rock itself is like an antenna that can draw to itself spiritual force of some sort. And where that force comes from, how it's created, that's all left as a mystery. But if you get into places where these things are believed in and have power, see, it's almost like it's the corporate will of the nation to believe this way, and then it enacts a certain environment. So you can be in a pantheistic environment and there's free will, then it'll look like pantheism is going on. But it isn't. It's an illusion. But do real things happen? Do rocks move? Do people have witchcraft? You know, do they give the witch doctors the power to send serpents to go bite people? That all seems to happen out there. Now, you say, well, then, if God has the power of life and death, can you go there and get bit by a serpent? And the answer is absolutely. Well, is a serpent going to bite you and kill you? The answer is, well, this depends on what you're doing. But if you're trusting in God and he doesn't want you killed, the answer is no. So could it be your time that you go to some crazy place and get bit by a snake that a witch doctor sent at you? Yes. Everybody dies somehow. Say, well, then that guy did it. No, you did it when you went there. What were you doing going there? You had a divine appointment. That's how you went there. So monism always gets behind what's happening, and the inspiration, that has to do with God, and nobody's trying to dodge that. God isn't trying to dodge that, and the Torah is not trying to dodge that. But sometimes people that think they're the gatekeeper for God try to dodge that, I think. You know, because they don't want to say God's a murderer or something like that. They're worrying about God's reputation or something. Well, that always perplexes me, because why would God let Satan run around the planet for 4,000 years and get more powerful if you look at Judaism and then learn Christianity? Why would he let this happen? It's like, if he let that happen, he can let all kinds of things happen to get you. You understand? But he's letting it happen. It's under his eyes. It's his oversight.
It sounds a little bit like what will be coming up next week, when he allows the enemies to prevail over us because we have gone so far forgetting about him.
Right. What's going to happen is, measure for measure, we're going to get back. And we're trying to get through this, although we've been sidetracked again because we're explaining things that we've been over. But I'm not trying to blame you here. I'm just saying we draw out the summary when we have people that haven't been to the last three or four sessions.
Well, thank you.
So Israel's assigned God's own portion, and God finds Israel in the wilderness. What happens is, Abraham is told in Genesis 15:13, Abraham's told, this guy's going to beget a nation. Now, Abraham has no kids. And Abraham's being told, you're not only going to have kids, you're going to have a nation. And you're going to have a land. In fact, they're going to be like the stars. And Abraham believes, and it's reckoned him as righteousness. Well, Abraham doesn't father the nations right then, but it's already reckoned to him as righteousness. He's going to get those nations because God has told him that, and that's part of the covenant. And Avram, exalted father, is going to become Avraham, the father of a mass of nations. Well, in between, he's going to have to give birth to Israel. Now, how does Abraham father Israel? The tradition's going to tell us. They're going to deal with the idea that Abraham is told, know for certain that they're going to be in this land that is going to oppress them 400 years. And the tradition will say, well, in the covenant of Bet-Tarim, the covenant between the pieces, when Abraham's out there under the stars and God has the tells him the promises, and then later at night there's a torch that moves between these pieces that Abraham had sacrificed. It's like Abraham is 70 at that point, and he's gone down to the land for a while, and then he's going to go back. And when he's 70, 30 years from then, is going to be the birth of Isaac. And then 400 years after that is going to be the exodus from Egypt. So Abraham's being told 430 years, but if you date it from Isaac's birth, 400 years. And that reconciles the 430 years in the New Covenant against the 400 years in the Torah. So what happens is, Abraham gets this promise that he's going to have a nation. And then after that, 430 years goes by, Isaac is born, and the next thing you know, Pharaoh's oppressing us, and it's been going on for a while. He killed the previous generation, almost knocked off Moses. Moses grows up, he's 40 now, it's another generation, and they're back to more killing the kids. So you had a Pharaoh father kill kids, and then a Pharaoh son kill kids. So it's across generations in a house, and now God weighs in and says, I'm not going to let that happen anymore. Time's up. And what does he do? Death of the firstborns, payback, measure for measure for Egypt, ransom, because there's blood spilled and the covenant is fulfilled. God gets his firstborn son, and in Exodus, we come out of Egypt at that point. Now, the book Shemot, this is a story, you know, of the names that went down. It's almost like, here's the names of the Exodus, the names of the going to Egypt. But the Septuagint, which is more redemptive and looking at for Messiah, we're out in Egypt and Alexandria. Alexander the Great has come through. he's taken over the world. Everybody's starting to speak Greek. And we're starting to wonder in Alexandria, you know, how long are we going to be under the yoke of the empire? And see, there's this movement that's going on in the text. Then they go, Exodus, we want to get out. We want to get out of Alexandria. We want to go back to Jerusalem. We want to rebuild a place. We want God to come back in his house. We're tired. We want out. We want the Messiah. We want God. We want to go back to the good old days when he dwelled in our midst and when he was in the temple. We want God to, you know, rule and be in charge. So there's a movement that in the Greek, to the Exodus, we're celebrating that he's redeemed us before and he can do it again, and we need it. You know, this is sort of the movement from the Torah to, you know, the lived history and the translation to the Greek. So Israel is being assigned its own portion, and God comes and he finds Israel after this Exodus. The Exodus happens like that. We get thrown out so fast, we don't even have a chance to put leaven in the bread, and so we're eating flatbread, right? Matzah. And we're in the wilderness, and God comes in, and he goes, Yimsaehu, you know, he found him in the wilderness. And what did he do? He nurtures us, he surrounds us, and he protects us like the little man in the pupil of the eye. So you look in the eye of somebody, and you see yourself or the other person. Who do you see?
Yourself.
Isn't that weird? You look into somebody's eye to see yourself? You ever think about looking at somebody to see yourself? You're using their pupil for a mirror, you see?
I remember a positive statement I learned once. Seeing ourselves in the eyes of others shall demand change. That's similar to get that other point of view from them.
That's right. Well, God loved us so much that he looks. And he loves us so much that he protects us like the little man in the pupil of his eye. Keishon Eno, in the little man of Eno, his eye. Yitrenu, he guarded him, Keishon Eno, like the little man in his eye. So he finds us in the wilderness when we're nothing. We're slave force that just got delivered. We walked across some dry ground because it dried up. Pharaoh's army got consumed because the deep closed in on him. We're out in the wilderness, and he found him in a howling wilderness. There's like, it's a demon haunt. It's a no place. It's got no resources. It's got cold. It's got too much heat. It's got no food. It's got no water. And he found us and surrounded us. So we're on the side of like Hagar being thrown out and you know, ready to die. Mm-hmm. And the story, he found us. And what did he do? He nurtured us. He guarded us like the pupil of his eye. You know, if you're in the sand and you got sand out there, you're in a wilderness, howling sand, it goes into your eye. What do you do about it? You leave it there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you start guarding your eye to keep the sand out, right? Mm-hmm. And you're going to be very careful because one little mistake, your eye tells you about it like this, right? Mm-hmm. Well, go into the pupil now and look at that little man there. He guarded us like that little man in the eye. And then what does he do? It says, the Lord alone guided us through the wilderness. So all of a sudden, it's like every other nation. They got land, and then they got a deity over them. This, not a real deity, an angelic principality. But the angelic principality is a big man for the nations, but it's a joke for God. And everybody now got their sandwich, their sandwich between a principality and the land, and they're stuck. And the land, it says, you know, they built gevulot, they built boundaries for the people. You know, he built boundaries for the people according to the number of the sons of God. So, according to the number of sons of God, and that's in the Septuagint and the Qumran, so we're talking, all the sources that predate the Masoretic text by 1,000 years are lined up on what it is. It's B'nai Elohim. The Masoretes, they got it out because people were going to get a wrong idea that God's got competition or that it's not a real monotheism or something else, that there's angelic principalities, some spiritual being that can compete with God for power. And it's like, yeah, but you don't get it. It's a joke. Mm-hmm. So now you're out there and you've got these principalities. Every other nation given land and a principality. Israel, not given land yet. And God alone guided him. So verse 12 ends, Adonai badad yanhenu, right? Adonai badad yanhenu el necha. The Lord alone, he guided him, and there's not with him a God that is foreign. So now look at verse 6. Is not he, you know, your father who ransomed you? You got your father, your co-creator God, And then you've got God alone guarded you. God alone guided you through the wilderness. So there's movement here where God the Father co-creates you, makes good on a promise to Abraham, brings you out through the wilderness, and saves you. And he takes you as his corporate son through this dangerous, horrible chaos that's going to overwhelm and kill you off. And he told Abraham that he was going to make him a father, not just a father, but an exalted father, Avram. And not just Avram, he's going to change his name to Abraham, father of a multitude of nations. And you got a national destiny now that's unique because your nation, you don't even have Canaan yet, and you're supposed to... And Jacob comes along, and you got Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob buried in the same cave in Hebron, and they get the same promise. You're going to get the land and the seed. You're going to have seed. They're going to live forever. Why are they going to live forever? Well, Abraham says, I was like 99. Well, he knew Shem was 99 when he got out of the ark and had a kid a year later. You know, Shem was 98, gets on the ark, spends a year up and down. That's days of Noah for him, for real. And then at 99, the ark, you know, the flood's over. It takes a year for the water to go up and down. Then the guy walks out there, and the next year he's 100 and he's got a kid. And he goes, ah, Arpachshad. Now, Abraham, nine generations later, with Shem still alive, he's laughing his guts out when he finds out God's making good at the age of 100. It's like, I should have figured that out. Even though people stop having kids at 100, I should have known God would, you know, like, redeem this situation. After all, Shem's going to come down here anyway and won't look at Yitzhak. He's coming to the bris. You know, I mean, this isn't just a legend. The guy's there. This isn't just an oral tradition. This was heard by the guy that told you. And the guy that told you lived the same experience. So when you start getting into really understanding, the fathers go through and vicariously appropriate the heritage for real. Shem probably looks like Abraham. After all, we're called Shemites. And Aver was there with Shem. Aver is a Hebrew. So the Shemite and the Hebrew cross over together and come down to the bruce of Isaac. And meanwhile, they're on their way to having this guy Jacob. And Jacob's going to be an angel fighter. Because when the guy is trying to go in the daytime, he says, let me out of here. Jacob goes, I won't let you go unless you bless me. Why? You busted my deed. I can't walk anymore. Mobility is the only way I can outrun my problems. Laban's over there. I can't go over here. Esau, I can't run anymore. I'm in trouble. Every time I ran away and, you know, started new one, you know, everything works out fine for me. And now you took away all my wives. You took away all my concubines. You took away all my property. You took away my goats, donkeys, cattle. You took everything away. And then you fight me all day. You blessed up my mobility. And he's broken. But I won't let you go. And he says, hey, well, let me go. How are you going to leave and bless me? All right already. Yisrael. Because you've mastered.
Prevailed.
You fought all night.
Wrestled.
And you wrestled with angels and men and prevailed. You have sarara, you have mastery over angels and men. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be fine with Esau now, and your kids are Yisrael, which has this unique destiny to struggle with national angels, to struggle with principalities. See, there's a corporate calling here. You know, Yeshua didn't bother to say some only come out by minion prayer or by national struggles. He told us about prayer and fasting and individual stuff. But see, there's a national destiny for Israel. Some of it might be a minion prayer. Some of it might be what nation has to go through. But these are corporate things playing out with nations, and it's corporate. It's not affecting an individual life. It's affecting national destinies, and it's affecting... Well, look at what's going on right now, you know. They got 150, 200 nuclear bombs over there in Israel. If they get too mad at the, you know, Islam and they throw a few bombs in the Persian Gulf, the lights go out here, right? We wouldn't like that. There's nothing we could do about it. So they got us. They got us by the kidneys. You know what I'm saying? They can squeeze there if they want. Now, how'd that happen? Well, this is part of a national destiny. And it plays out. So when you're trying to understand the order in the universe, how do we get spread out? Well, we got kicked out of the Garden of Eden. How do we get clothed? Well, you know, we put on clothing because we were ashamed. Well, I thought now that we have Yeshua, we can repent and take our clothes off. It doesn't work that way. Well, I thought when you repent, everything's new, made new, right? Look at
Let's
that.
Let's make it happen.
There's a mom over there. She says you can't take your clothes off. What is that? I thought you were bad. All things are new. It's great, you know. There's consequences. And you mean since the Garden of Eden, we still got consequences? We can't just get back and set up paradise like this? How do you get back there? That's what Israel's doing. They're on a national journey to try to get back there. And Adam, you know, passed it down to Jacob. And Jacob's sitting there saying, well, what am I going to do? He becomes Israel and he's fighting Esau's angel. Then what? You're in and out. The Romans are coming, the Assyrians, the Babylonians. But meanwhile, look what keeps happening. You got land and seed. What does seed mean? There's always going to be a remnant. What does land mean? You're going to get back there one day. What happens when you have land and seed? You should live forever. You will. Your immortality started when? When your 100-year-old father gave birth to, you know, through a woman that was 90 in a dead womb, gave birth ex nihilo to some being that never should have come into existence and that never should have been born. Who then Abraham offered back in faith because he was going to cut his throat to make him an olah. And then every Jew grows up saying, I'm an olah. And when the Holocaust comes, you're an olah. You go up. A third of the Jews go up. You read Revelation, a third of the world is going to go up. Well, they already paid to play one round. National destinies, again, playing out. So when we go back to this beginning here, God finds Israel in the wilderness. He guards him as a pupil of his eye. He alone guides him through the wilderness. And then last week we dealt with what does he do after that? He teaches us to be an angel, an eagle. Who is an eagle? Eagle's a king predator. He takes what he wants, when he wants it. He oversees creation. He flies. He puts his nest up high where nobody can get. He sleeps when he wants to sleep. He has his kids up there. He comes down, takes what he wants, goes back. He runs his life just the way he wants, and everything else he looks down on and comes and goes the way he wants. So it's like, whoa, gee, I wish I were an eagle. Well, the Romans had it. The Americans had it. We're a superpower. We're the eagle. We got satellites. We watch everything going on. We capture sound. We can hear every conversation going on in the world. Everyone. Bug it. Everything's bugged. We see, hear everything. That's what an eagle does. You've got great eyesight. So these national destinies, I'm just playing with you here to show you some of what the stories are. That the elders told that we're looking at. And their continuities. When the temple was there before, you know, the Romans were in charge and they want to put an eagle right in the temple. Jews went crazy. And the Romans said, okay, anything but an eagle in the temple, we won't put an eagle inside the temple. They couldn't get, they gave up on it. And, you know, the United States today, you know, we're saying land for peace, well, anything but Jerusalem. Well, let's try Jerusalem too. We'll candidate to get Barack in there, and then we'll make a deal with Barack that Arafat absolutely couldn't walk away from. Clinton had it all engineered. He sent Carvel down there. He got Barack elected. Barack agreed. Arafat was standing there. The whole thing was put together perfectly. And Arafat looks and says, you know, I'm an Arab, and, you know, Hamas will kill me if I go for anything, unless I get everything. So I'd rather get killed by you than Hamas. It's easier to say no to you than go back there and get killed by Hamas. You think I'm a, you know, you think I'm Anwar Sadat? I'm not Sadat. I'm not going to die, you know, doing some martyr act for you guys.
Well, see, Arafat thought if the Americans kill him, then he'll still get his virgins.
Yeah, he would.
But if his own people kill him, he loses everything.
Yeah, it's terrible to choice there.
Well, the plan was brilliantly successful at getting him to say that, which he wouldn't do.
That's right. Then. Clinton did a great job on that. And he had a good Clinton solution, too. You know, we'll give you the top and we'll keep the bottom for the Jews. Nobody looks at the bottom. And they're still trying, you know, you just said, they're digging up artifacts right now. Here comes the first temple seal, you know, today while we're talking about it, you know. All right. So the eagle then, he takes us up. What does he do? He suckles us with honey, you know. Let's read those verses. Some here really just haven't got
verse
it.
Verse 13.
13. He made him mount the heights of the land. He made him eat the produce of the field. He suckled him with honey from the rock, with oil from the flinty boulder, the butter of cattle and milk of the flock, with fat of lambs and rams of Bashan and he-goats, with fat of the kidneys of wheat and the blood of grapes you drank fermented, but grew fat, little straight one, and he kicked. You grew fat, you grew thick, you gorged. He forsook God who made him.
Himach, the rock of his salvation. They made him red-faced with strangers. With abominations they anchored him. They sacrificed to the demons and no God. God's not, had they known them. To new ones lately they came in. Not had they dreaded them, your fathers. The rock who birthed you, you ignored. And you forgot God who brought you forth. So the eagle's taken up. And what does he do? He takes him out for a ride and says, well, you know, you start, what do humans start with? Milk. So we start you with the honey. We start you with oil. Start you with simple stuff. And then after that, we move on. And what do we give you? You know?
Butter.
Pat of butter, milk.
Fat of lambs.
Fat of lambs. Then we take you to Bashan where you can get the choice. Lambs. The choice, you know, today it would be corn-fed beef. Over there it was choice grain. Remember all the tribes, the Texans, the firstborns, who had all the cattle, didn't want to cross over. The real reason they didn't want to cross over is because perfect grazing land was in the other side of the Jordan, the west side of the Jordan. So the guys with the money and the wealth bogged down before crossing into the promised land, and then they get knocked off first when the empires come to knock off everybody. So, you know, you cash in early and you cash out early is what happens to you. But meanwhile, they've got all this cattle over there, and they're going to live for, you know, a few hundred years really nice because they got corn-fed beef out there. And so he gives us that. And so an eagle, you know, what are we getting? We're getting the choice. We're getting the kidneys of the wheat. That's the
healthy part.
The healthy part, the wheat germ, which was really, you know, if you get hungry and you eat wheat germ, it's filling.
Yeah.
So a little bit of wheat germ, you try eating grape nuts, you know, you fill up. You don't need to eat a whole lot.
Yeah.
So we got grape nuts for you. We got, you know, filet mignon minus the gied, because you can't eat the Jacob's hip. He's running around with that. And you got to respect that the guy lost his mobility. But you can have every other kind of meat, the best of the meats. You just can't eat that nerve, the sinew that's in the filet mignon part, out of respect for the memory of Israel when he got named. Because this is your name, and you got to master it. You can't get sidetracked. So,
Geed
is sinew.
Sinew.
Okay. So, you want to know where it is? It's your sciatica. You know, it's
that.
You got to get sciatica.
Oh,
yeah, okay, pull it out. You feel much better when they pull it out, don't you? Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. After you.
So, what happens? The eagle takes us out. We get honey, we get wheat. And then, you know, Damenav Tishtechamer, right? The blood of grapes you drank fermented. So we got filet mignon, almost. We got Cabernet to go with it, yeah. So you're drinking the Cabernet, you're having a good time, and Cloyd, what happens? We grow fat, we grow gross, we gorge. We just don't know where to stop. What happens after we don't know where to stop?
We forsake God.
Yeah, we start worshiping demons. We start at like a Psalm 106. We're feeding our kids to the demon gods and all that. So then what happens? We shed innocent blood and pollute the land. Now, that's what the Canaanites are doing. All of a sudden, we're doing that. He warns us, if we're going to be like the Canaanites, we're going to be thrown out like the Canaanites. Well, I dare say that if the nation did it again right now, I don't care what Christian theology would say, if we were doing that, he'd throw us out again.
Mm-hmm.
He's either got to cut it short or not let us get there. Because if he lets us get there, meanwhile, who is doing that? Who's doing that right now? Suicide bombers.
Mm-hmm.
They're sacrificing firstborn sons to their God to get a nation.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we've been there, done that. Psalm 106, 37, and 38, we already did that. And what did he do? He threw us out. Now they're doing it, and the world's with them. Good luck to them. You understand? It's come up against God. Now God swore an oath to Abraham at Moriah. That's Mount Moriah. That's Jerusalem. That's the temple site. That he wouldn't let the nations take that land because they gave that land as our inheritance, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys that spurned the birthright, look where they're at. They all of a sudden they want that land. Because Ishmael intermarries Esau. They get Islam, and then they want that land. So Esau didn't give up on the birthright after he said, oh, what do I care? Give me Edom, Edom. Give me that red. What good does it matter if I die? Give me the porridge. Give me the lentils. But all of a sudden he wants the land too.
And I insist that God picked a place that was far away from everything, just so that they had no resources, no interest anywhere except that he made his name to dwell there. And that's why everybody wants it. They want the antiquity and the religious punch that goes with the fact that God has done something there for thousands of years, starting with Abraham and moving across to the first temple and moving across to times of Yeshua and up to today. And that's all I want to steal back, is all the work he's done for thousands of years among mankind when this whole thing starts. So, look, summoned to heaven and earth, they're going to be the witnesses. There it is, heaven and earth. And who's there? That what? That God is going to let his rain trickle like dew, and his teachings of Torah go into human hearts and transform the world. And then what happens? Well, the story is that Yeshurun got twisted, and should he have been twisted? Well, no. Why? God raised us right. He taught us to be an eagle. He took us to high places. He gave us everything we wanted to eat. We took what we wanted. We were raised right. And what do? We overate. We stuffed ourselves. We got into gods of the nations, including Johnny-come-lately gods, new ones, Shadim, gods that our fathers didn't even know about, the fear. So there's no excuse anymore. We don't have the subliminal fear of our fathers, that other demons that haunted the wilderness, that everybody around them were afraid of, and our fathers were afraid because they were out there being afraid like everybody and transmitting that fear to us. No, we got newfangled gods that our fathers weren't even afraid of, didn't know about, and we're embracing, we're doing the same whoring act as the nations did. So it's like we're not happy with our place, which is, here's your land, here's your God. Everybody got one of those, and everybody's going to be jealous about you being in your land with your God. No. You're busy whoring after their God and their lands. And their God isn't real, and their lands, you're supposed to take over the earth. You're the eagle. So we got it all backwards, okay? And this is plan A for, you know, God taking over the earth. And we're not doing it. And it's an ex nihilo man, raised to be an angel killer. It's an eagle who's supposed to take over the world by worshiping God and things going right for you because you got blessing. Instead, we're not doing it. So we get cloyed, we worship the demons, we shed innocent blood, and at the end it says, Hu ascha, no, vetishkach el mcholelecha, and you forgot God who brought you forth. And this God that brought you forth, we learned that was writhing labor. It's really a feminine giving birth. It's the real, this is like right down there, the labor pains of delivery. So you've got a feminine aspect of God playing out here. So you've got God the masculine, who procreated us and co-created us and ransomed us. God, the masculine God, in verse 6. And in verse 12, God alone guided us through the wilderness and raised us as an eagle. And it's, you know, like an eagle stirs forth its nest, kino. It could have said kina, her nest. This is not a mother eagle. Like an eagle, you know, stirs up its nest. And all the images are masculine in there. So you got a male eagle teaching us to fly. And now, at the end, even though this is a male use of the word, like mecholelecha, it's writhing in labor coming forth. So then when you get to verse 19, and God saw and spurned because of vexation, he saw and, see, the question becomes, if God raised us right, and you know, he teaches the suckle, and then we spurn him and we forget our heritage, and we forget Father God, we forget Mother God. No matter if he's tender to us like a mother, or he's tough like a father, our response, both cases, is, we want to whore after other nations' gods, and we want to be like them. He goes, I don't believe this. I raise you ex nihilo. The stories are told. You come out. I make good on my promise to Abraham. I make good on my promise to Moses and Pharaoh. I take you and find you in the wilderness. I gather you as a people. I come to you at Mount Sinai. I give you the Torah. And what do you guys do about it? Give me the raspberry. So we're in verse 19 now. We're going to have 10 verses of God's response to all this kindness that he did. This is how we pay him back. Here comes payback. You know, it's like,
this is his response.
This is going to be his response now. So, what do you have? Another hour on the review, and now we're ready to read the Torah, right? Excuse me. So, we'll open it up, right?
Baruch Hu Et Aronai Hamavorach. Baruch Aronai Hamavorach Leolam Vaed. Baruch Aronai Hamavorach Leolam Vaed. Baruch Ata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Asher Bachar Banu Mikol Ha'amim V'Natan Lanu Et Torato. Baruch Ata Adonai Noten HaTorah. Amen. Blessed is the Lord, the Blessed One.
Blessed is the Lord, the Blessed One,
for all eternity. Blessed is the Lord, for all eternity. Blessed are you, O Lord, our God, King of the universe, who has chosen us from among all people and given us his Torah. Blessed are you, O Lord, giver of the Torah. Vayar Adonai vayinatz mikas vanav uvnotav vayomer Astira fanai mehem erema acharitam ki dor tapuchot hema panim lo emun pan hem ki nuni v'lo el ki asuni b'ad lehem v'ani akdiem b'lo am v'goy naval achishem כי יש קדך באפי, ותיקד עד שאול תקטיז, ותאכל ארץ בבולת, ותלהט מושתי חרים, אשפי עלי מוראות, חיצי אכלי פעם, מזה רעב, ולחום מרשת וקצת מרירי, בשם בימות אשלח בם, אם חמד זו קלי עפר, מחוץ תשקל חרב ומחדרים אימה, גם בחור גם בתולה יונק משתיבה. אמרתי אפיהם אשבית מנוש יקרם לולי כעס אויב אגור פן ינקרו צרמו פן יאמרו ידינו רמה ולא אדוני פעל כל זאת כי גוי עובד עצות המה ואין בהם תבונה. I'll close the blessing and then we'll do it in English, okay? ברוך אתה אדוני אלוהינו מלך העולם אשר נתן לנו תורת אמת וחיי עולם נטע בתוכנו ברוך אתה אדוני נותן התורה אמן. Yes, okay. Please be seated. Right, I'm going to try to give you a 1 minute per verse. How's that? In 10 minutes from now, we'll reassess. That sound good?
Sure.
Okay. Let's start in English, verse 19, and sing it. And saw the Lord and spurned because of vexation his sons and his daughters. So here's God's response to a heritage forgotten. He's put in all this time. Father God, Mother God, the God that co-created us, that ransomed us, the God that taught us to fly as an eagle, the God that writhed in labor to give us birth and guarded us like the pupil of his eye in the wilderness. This God responds when we're whoring after other gods with abject disgust. Vayinatz is like irritated. He's irritated over it. He saw and he was irritated over our actions. And Mikas, because of the vexation, this is an anger that arises from watching a child commit an abomination. This is an anger that arises when the child goes and worships foreign gods. He's red-faced when we want another nation's god. When we make an idol, he's red-faced. When we bow down to the idol, he's vexed. And if we're going to vex him by our actions, then we're sowing
first being red-faced, and then we're reaping being jealous. And we're sowing, when we worship an idol, run after another nation's gods, sacrifice our children to foreign gods, like we did with the Shadim and the Canaan after we went in there, Psalm 106, 37, and 38, then God is going to respond by saying, okay, let the rock that you poured out your oil to and the sacrifice to, let that save you. Let that be your rock. You're going to worship some other rock? Then let that be your rock. This is what you're going to reap. So we're going to reap vexation from God. So here it comes. Verse 20. And he said, I want to hide my face from them. I want to see what is there hereafter. For a generation upside down are they, children without faithfulness in them. So God says, okay, I'm nauseated, I'm going to turn my face. So if he's not watching, what happens? Blessing dries up. Blessing flows when he's looking at us. When he's not looking at us, the absence of blessing. So we're losing power in life. Then what happens? It's not total, because he says, I want to see what is there hereafter. So even though he turned his face, he says, I want to see. So there's a partial turning of the face. If you turn completely, I'm sorry, it's the days of Noah, it's the flood, we're wiped out. We're exterminated by our enemies. We're destroyed completely. The experiment's over. Heaven and earth will roll up as a bad experiment. Jeremiah 33, it says, it's the days and nights. As long as days and nights are going on, my covenant's in force. And when heaven and earth roll up as a scroll, that's when the experiment's over. And that's when I've had it total. And when he ceases to pour energy into creation, that's what can happen, because he keeps the forces of chaos at bay every day by pumping vital energy into keeping things ordered. Otherwise, it just falls apart immediately. So he's saying, well, we're an upside-down generation, children without faithfulness. So even though he's turning his face, he wants to see what is our hereafter. It's going to be very important. We're going to come back to that later in this poem. But meanwhile, who are we? We're children. Lo emun ba'am. There's no faithfulness in them. What kind of covenant is this when we're the whores and we have no faithfulness? What kind of marriage is it when you have a faithless couple? You understand? Things dissolve. So verse 21. They made me red-faced with a no God, angered me with vexed me with airy isles, and I shall make them red-faced with a no people. With a nation of fools, I shall vex them. This is the Havel Naval plan, right? God says, you take the Havel, you take the idols, then I'll take the Naval, I'll take the fools. So you got your stupid idols, I got my stupid nation. Who's my stupid nation? It's going to be a no people. So who's a stupid nation that are no people? All the non-Jews, it's the Gentiles. I'll take the Gentiles while you take the idols. So the Havel Naval plan, you just traded me in, I trade you in. Who's going to be my God? My people are going to be the no people, the Gentiles, and I'm going to do that to make you jealous. And in fact, I'm going to vex you by what I do to those guys, because I'm really bummed. Payback then for verse 6. He says, you guys are omnival by your actions. You're a dori keshu taltol. You're a twisted generation, twisted and crooked. Then you're a omnival, a foolish people. I'll take the goy naval. I'll take the... So payback for verse 6, it's right now. And Paul's going to quote this in Romans 10:19 when he said, Israel, didn't they know? So, well, they heard. Yeah, he said, yeah, we know they heard. Well, because it's going out to the world. Well, didn't they know? Yeah, they knew. And what did they do about it? They vexed me with airy idols. That's what they knew. Well, then what's going to happen? I'm going to be found by a people that aren't looking for me. And that's the argument Paul's going to develop then. Rav Shaul's going to develop in Romans 10, going to 11, to say, well, then what advantages have the Jews if this is what's going on? And he's going to detail it. He's going to lay it out. All right, so verse 22 then. For a fire has ignited in my nostrils. It will burn to Sheol beneath, devour the earth and her produce, and scorch the foundations of mountains. So flames are kindled. Idolatry kindles wrath. We commit idolatry, God's response, wrath. Wrath is the opposite of blessing. Wrath is what triggers a cursing. In the covenant, we have a choice. We can be under the blessing of God or the cursing of God. Even if we're under the cursing of God, he swore an oath to Abraham he wouldn't wipe us out. He said there'll be a remnant. So we're a nation that's going to live forever. God swore an oath we're going to live forever. We're never going to get wiped out. We're immortal on earth as a nation, not as individuals. We'll always be fathers that have sons. But when whole generations are going down the tubes, what is God going to do about it? He's going to be mad. He's going to spread us out. He's going to scatter us to four corners of the earth. We're going to be few in number. I'm told there were 10% of in the days of the Roman Empire. 100 million people were walking around besides the Chinese. And 10 million of them were Jews. The Romans came and they knocked out 3 million here, they knocked out 3 million there. Twice. Two wipeouts, 70 and 135. So we went from 10 million down to 3 million right there. And we went from 10% of the world population to 3%. And then we start going down, and now we're 0.3%. Because we just keep going down. And we go up and down, but the trend line is down. And why? Because we don't keep the covenant. So he spreads us out and makes us few in number and shows that he can keep a covenant by keeping a balance of power between the Jews and the Gentiles, even when we're 0.3% of the congregation. Well, think about it. If you've got to be God, you've got to put all the Jews in New York and in Washington, D.C. and in Tel Aviv and give them Jerusalem if you're trying to keep that kind of a balance going. How else are you going to have a balance between keeping the covenant to Abraham, having the Jews few in number and still, you know, not wiped out off the map, while you're giving them periodic episodes of blessing so they can get their act together, because when they're starving to death and being chased, they're not thinking about anything but survival, so you've got to give them a chance to get out of that. And you said they're going to be a light to the nation, so you've got to keep building up while you scatter them and chase them out of nations all the time. And you got to do this for 2,000 years, and people are going to, you know, say, oh, well, I don't get it. What don't you get about this? So we go to verse... so anyway, this flames are kindled, idolatry kindles wrath that burns the foundation of mountains. Verse 23. I will heap upon them evils with my arrows. I will finish them. There are four major arrows: sword, famine, wild beasts, and pestilence. And it just radiates through creation and through the deep and through nature. So you've got these wild beasts coming up, scorpions biting people like in the wilderness. Later on, you've got wild beasts running over the place because we're supposed to conquer the land little by little, Deuteronomy 7:22. So if you're unconquering the land little by little, you're being overrun by wild beasts. So this pattern is either you order creation or you disorder creation, and meanwhile you're getting chased by wild beasts, and then you're getting chased by the real wild beasts, and they're going to come in verse 23 and so on. Now there's one god, Reshev, is mentioned in here. Reshev is a Syro-Phoenician deity. You know what he is? He's a war god, and he shoots arrows. He puts famine, plague, like Dever, plagues on the cattle and plagues on people. And he's a war god. So, you know, the war comes and then we'll ravage with plague. And the wild animals our animals are dying, and we're dying, and he's shooting arrows at us. All of a sudden, here's your monism, Reshef is an arrow. Instead of Reshef being a war god that shoots arrows, he's an arrow in God's quiver. And this is what God does with these supposed deities. They're a big joke to him. Like Milton's, Satan was a monkey to Milton, God's monkey. Milton's view of Satan was that he was a monkey that stirred the pot. This is right out of Hazin. So here you've got verse 24. Now, you got the arrows being shot, and he says, I'm going to expend my arrows. Now remember, there's a relationship between the blood of grapes that's going to go through creation. Blood of grapes is like really nice. That's wine. Blood of grapes you drank fermented. Noah got that in the days of Noah. First thing he did was go out and make a thing of wine, right? Noah didn't get in trouble. His kid got in trouble for that. He allows us to have the wine. It's the abuse of the wine. He comes after us when we grow fat, gorge, overboard, and start making that a god, and then start worshiping other gods so we can get more and more. And we're into greed and overstuffing and going crazy rather than into worshiping God and realizing we're eagles and that he's teaching us to fly and that he's the only guy we got to worry about as far as being on the dole. So here's where it goes. The nations, we got the Phoenician fire god who smites men and cattle. These arrows are unleashed, and now you've got sword, famine, wild beasts, and pestilence coming up. So things are falling apart for us. This is wartime and curse time. So verse 24, wasted by famine and ravaged by plague and pestilence so bitter. Fangs of beasts I'll let loose on them with venom of creepers in the dust. So the forces of nature are released. the land's being overrun by wild animals. That's Deuteronomy 7:22, unwinding the wrong way. Instead of little by little we conquer the land and civilize it, it's little by little we lose control over the land and we lose the roads and we lose the ability to have commerce and we lose the ability to travel between cities, and there's carnivores out there and it's dangerous. And, you know, then verse 25, it's breaking down further. Outside deals death the sword, and from rooms terror, both young men and young women, infants with men of gray hair. So warfare and destruction. Now men are unleashed as the ultimate carnivores, and they're coming after us, and society's defenseless are dying. When you say, well, why the women and the children? The answer goes back to when he got mad at our sons and our daughters. And why did he get mad at our sons and our daughters? Because we spurned God the Father, we spurned God the Mother. We spurned God being tender toward us, and we sowed the fact that there's nothing that's working, whether the tenderness root or the respect root. We don't have the tenderness of the Mother and respect for God, and we don't have respect for God the Father. We don't have love for the Mother or respect for the Father. We don't have love or respect for God. We just want our thing. So the carnivores are unleashed, and what do? They go after, they tear down the whole society, and the women with young children are getting killed, the elderly are getting killed, the women of a marriageable age are getting killed. All the defenseless of society, that the reason you need a society to keep going on is grace for at least these guys, because they're not out doing what all these other guys are doing, the priests that are whoring after gods, and the soldiers that are killing people, and the men that are craving and no justice in the courts, and everybody trying to steal. These are the people inside the houses that, you know, are loving people, and it's falling apart for them too. Well, why? Because across generations, the time's running out. So we get to verse 26. It gets even tougher. I would have said, I'll hack them to pieces, cause to cease from mankind their remembrance. Hack them to pieces, this paya, it comes from corners. You can really say, I would have said, I'll four-corner them. I'll spread them out to the north, the south, and the east, and the west. And the pays are like the sides you're supposed to leave in the field. I'm going to leave them desolate, wandering around. I'm going to spread them out so that they don't. There's no military left. There's wandering people. And they don't have any homes. They don't have any property. They don't have any direction. Nothing. I'll spread them to the four corners of the earth. And then after that, I'll wipe them out as a people so they'll cease to exist. And their memory will cease to exist. And so he says, I'll Shabbat them. I'll cause to Shabbat them. I'll cause to cease them. Ashabita, this is a Hefil form of Shabbat. I will cause to cease from activity and creative activity these people. I will wipe out, and not only that, from mankind, their memory. I will cease from the minds of other people their existence. So he's talking about a complete brutal. The Nazis tried to do it when they were. The second death was to cremate and erase any funeral, erase any stones, erase any bodies, erase any traces. They just wanted to put up the chimneys, the ashes, and let that scatter so that it could be not denied later that there even was a people ever. That kind of thing. That's what's called the second death. Yeah, I'm going to not only wipe you out, I'm going to wipe out your memory. So God is so mad, he says, I'm going to wipe out their memory even. I would have. It's subjunctive. Amarti is, I would have, Ashbita, I you see it especially in verse 27 here. Lule, except the taunt of the enemy I dread, lest would they construe his foes, lest they would say our hand is held high, and that the Lord has done all this. So our hand held high. I mean, when Moses walked out, we walked out of Egypt, the Yad Ramah, with our hands held high. When the redemption finally came, we walk out triumphant. When the enemies would put their hands up and high, they're saying, we're in charge. We did this with our hands. Moses, when he's holding up the stick, he had Joshua and Caleb over there holding his hands up high. They had the victory going as long as they could hold that stick up there. See? You hold the staff up there. And when you're getting tired, the hand's going down, so's the military victory. They put it back up, prop the guy up. And then with his hand up high, they vanquished everybody. As long as he can hold their hands up high. So God's saying, now the enemy's holding their hands up high, and they're saying, Lo Adonai pa'al kol zot, and no God has done all this? Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh didn't do this? Who did this?
We did it with our hands. We beat up those Jews. We killed them all. He doesn't like that, see? Except the taunt of the enemies. Because why? I'm trying to reach out to corporate mankind, and when I'm my own people are getting what they sowed. They're reaping what they sowed. The enemy's getting the wrong idea. They're trying to take credit for the fact that I'm launching this jihad here against my own people. That I'm giving the enemy the victory. In the past, they always worried because I was God over Israel and they wipe out everybody. With the Sichon, wipe out Og, wipe out Pharaoh, wipe out anybody who comes. Meanwhile, keep Shabbat, have a nice time. And now what's happened? The reverse. And what's the enemy saying? We did this. So God says that there's a deterrent. I'm not going to get my message across to mankind that I'm God over all the world if the enemy is misconstruing and thinking they did this. So it's got nothing to do with Israel's righteousness. He would have sacked us to pieces and obliterated our memory. That's how badly he was affected by our whoring after foreign gods. But the experiment's not going to end yet because he's not rolling up heaven and earth as a scroll. He hasn't given up despite having a bad marriage. He'll have Hosea marry Gomer and go through the same thing. I mean, he's been down this path, see, many times teaching this across generations. The lived history of the people through the prophets. And he makes man participate in all these realities. Now he's got this problem. So verse 28.
For a nation lost in counsel are they, and there's not among them understanding.
All right, the picture is this. You see the grapes up on the doorpost there? God gives us the grapes, and he lets us drink wine, ferment it, and he lets us be eagles to soar creation. But we turn around and we overdo it. And then what happens? We start mirroring creation in our own image. So what happens? It starts getting thorny and bristly. It starts to mirror our kind of carnivore behavior. Instead of looking like a place that angels would make, it looks like a place that death would dwell. And we start having the earth mirror our spiritual disaster. So the earth becomes made over in our image. We pave it over. We make it into industrial dump zones. We make it into places that have bitter fruits. And then what happens when it has all these bitter fruits? The carnivores come out of the land and they start to roll back reality. And wild beasts start to take over. Instead of ordering creation and putting it under man's management, and man is running it like an angel would run it, that was obedient to God, man is running it as a carnivore that pays it no attention, and it's being ignored, it's being diminished, and it's being rolled back. So the wild beasts are coming out, the scorpions are coming out, the carnivores are coming out, everything that bites and kills is coming out. And death is taking over, and the opposite of sanctifying life is taking over all creation. Now, as that's happening, the carnivore armies come, and they start eating up everything, including Israel. So now we're under carnivore domain, whether it's the Romans or the Assyrians or the Babylonians. These guys come out and take over the planet. And then when they take over the planet, they're drunk with victory. So they're standing there like this. All of a sudden, the wine that's worked its way through fangs of wild beasts, through serpents that bite in the night, through now the carnivores that bite by leaving blood on the ground and putting their hands up and going, no, God did this, we did, ah! And they're in that, and that's taken over. And God's looking at that. He doesn't like it. But meanwhile, this is what we've sown, and this is what we've reaped. So now creation has become occupied and dominated by the carnivore men who are the worst of the worst of the carnivores. And this is God's response because he raised us right and we spurned him. So now we're left. Jihad makes drunk the victor. And he says this nation perishes counsel. I mean, they've got no understanding. And not only that, it's more ironic. Israel, who used to customarily have jihads that always worked for them, are now on the side, the reverse side of a jihad. Now one chases 1,000 Israelites. Two put to flight 10,000 Israelites. Israel used to be the giant killer. Now they're getting run over by anybody that's running around saying, no, God has done all this. God has switched sides. Now you get your dualism here? Mm-hmm. God is now Israel's enemy and playing carnivore and biting and killing young women and children and old men and everything else. And he's doing it all in the name of being mad at us over what we've done. And he's putting the mirror in our face to make us red-faced.
over our idolatry, and to make us dominated by a no people, a brutal people like the Scythians, a brutal people like these the Canaanite guys that are running over us, like all these Reshef, all these guys. They're running over us, and we're whoring after their gods, and they're killing us. And the carnivores are rolling back reality on the order that we were supposed to impose on creation. So that's where it leaves us now. That's the end of verse 28. It's like, okay, what's happening? It's just going the wrong way. Well, what's happening? It's gotten to a point where we're being dominated by guys that are saying, no, God has done all this. Is it the end? Is he going to roll up the whole scroll? Is it the end of the experiment? Are the carnivores going to triumph and then heaven and earth going to roll up as a scroll? And the experiment's over. Annihilates everybody. Is that where it's going? We don't know. It's out of control. Chaos is starting to overwhelm. God is mad, and the bad guys have turned into carnivores, and they're winning huge. And we're on the run, and we don't even get why they're kicking the hell out of us. They don't know why they're kicking the hell out of us, and we don't know why they're kicking the hell out of us. Everybody has forgotten Torah, forgotten thousands of years of history, forgotten what, they're not reading what's written down. They don't have this song in their heart. And remember, Moses was told, put this in the song of the children's heart, so when this is happening, at least they'll have this song. They won't have Torah, they won't have been raised by their fathers, right? But when they're being scattered and they're in foreign countries, at least they'll have grown up with this childhood song and they'll be able to figure out why this moment has come. That God could turn around and become Satan to us, the adversary. That's where we leave.
Oh, give us a preview.
The preview is verse 30. I'm going to ask you, who says it? You know, preview is verse 30. We'll sing it in the English. How can pursue one a thousand and two put to flight 10,000? If not, their rock had sold them and the Lord had handed them over. I want to know who says that. And I want to know who he's talking to. So you can go home with that preview in mind. You're now looking at the reverse jihad. Because it's God, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, that handed us over. And he's asking, how does this happen? And everybody else is lost in counsel. So where are we going here? We're being routed. The carnivores are triumphing. And nobody has a clue. The enemies don't have a clue. Israel doesn't have a clue. God's handing us over. He's playing Satan. And we're out there going, ah! And nobody cares. And the planet's not being run very well. And what order is coming into reality? Just carnivores and snakes and serpents and hot venom of wild bees and things unloosed while women and children are dying and elderly. And the sword, and everybody's terror-stricken indoors and getting killed, and they're outdoors, they're wandering around disappearing, and whole Israel's army wiped out, and there's nothing around. And they're beating the hell out of us, and no end in sight, and nobody gets a clue what's going on. That's where we're left. That's the moment of truth. Now look out, because it's not like you can say, well, we've been there, done that, and that won't happen again. Get a clue. In the end of days, that this is what happens. This is the future. This is the prophetic poem. So the outcome of this is very important. And going through this is a part of the process. And if you'd been reading this in the days of the Holocaust, it would have been a strengthening experience for you. Or if you'd grown up with this song, you could have gone into the camps and maybe you had a chance. Because if this was in your heart, you'd be going, I understand who the Nazis are. And I know where they're coming from. I know who they're coming for. And I get it. I get it. If this will get you through the Holocaust, what else will it get you through? Mm-hmm. And not only that, you got to understand where it's going. There's an order. Mm-hmm. So, this is the Torah. By the hand of Moshe, by the command of God. You see that big hay there? Somebody point out that hay. If people haven't seen it before. This is an interrogative hay. It says, is. Is it to the Lord you pay back this? O foolish people and not wise, is not he your father who ransomed you? He made you and he established you. This is the Torah. It's by the hand of Moshe, by the command of God. Vizod Torah Asher Samoshe Lifnei Bnei Yisrael Al Pi Adonai Beyond Moshe.
tree of life it is for those who take hold of it. Long life is in its right hand, and in its left, riches and honor. The Lord was pleased for the sake of his righteousness to render the Torah great and glorious. It's Chayim Pi L'Makazikim Ba V'Tomecha
Me'yusha D'Racheha Takenoam V'Chol Netivotecha Shalom, Ashivenu Adonai, Eleka Benashuba, Chadesh, Chadesh Abenu, Chadesh Abenu
Lord, and we shall be turned. Renew our days. Our generation is in days long ago. In Yeshua's name. Amen.
Amen.